Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me? Good. Okay. My name is Agnes Beretz, and it's a pleasure to welcome you at the Brown Bag Lunch Lecture Series. As you know, I will be talking today about abstract expressionism and the abstract expressionism show in here in New York at MoMA. But before I would say anything more meaningful than this, I would like to ask you to turn off your phones. So let's make sure that we will not be troubled by any kind of, you know, lovely noises in the upcoming 45 minutes. Also, I will have time after the lecture for questions and comments, so please feel free to kind of, you know, gather your ideas or remarks, and we can talk about those after the lecture. Okay, I will start showing you a picture, an image, which shows the big picture that is the entrance to the fourth floor exhibition galleries. And I'm starting with this for two reasons. First of all, because I want you to realize that obviously the exhibition, I'm not sure how many of you seen it, but those of you seen, there is also a question, which part have you seen it? You know that the show is not only the exhibition which unfolds featuring over 100 works on the fourth floor of the museum, but also two extremely important, very useful other exhibitions taking place on the second and the third floor of the museum galleries, which do not merely offer comments or footnotes to what is about to unfold on the fourth in the big picture section, but also they are actually important kind of, you know, collections of objects, text, even moving images, which do problematize this very story, if you like, the master narrative, which is featured in this section, the big picture section of the exhibition. So please make sure that you see all the three of them. And since it's a monumental undertaking, the whole show itself, maybe seeing them multiple times might be also a good idea, I guess. So what I'm doing here today is manifold. I'm here to tell a story, but there is not one story to tell, but many, many stories. In fact, that there is a whole polyphonic kind of overlapping histories which we can evoke whenever we think about abstract expressionism in New York, especially when it is on view at this museum, the Museum of Modern Art. The stories which kind of come into being or which resonate with this exhibition are about not just the emergence of late modernist painting in the United States. It's not just about also the kind of the dissemination of certain critical idioms, preeminently kind of, you know, advocated by critics such as Clement Greenberg or Harold Rosenberg in the 1940s, 50s, early 60s New York. It's also about the question of collective artistic representation. Is there such a thing as a group? How to define a group? How to kind of assume a position for collectively appear as an entity in the emerging New York art world? This exhibition is also about stories which are hardcore stories taking place during the Cold War, and they are also about the institutional agency and power of museums, especially this very museum, the Museum of Modern Art. Why did I finish with this last subplot or substory? Because as you probably know, every single press review and the press release itself emphasize the fact that MoMA and abstract expressionism or the New York School belongs to each other. They're almost one kind of, you know, inseparable entity. And I would like to start with this to show you that that was not always the case. So what I'm doing here today, since there is no way for me to tell all these stories conjointly in overlap for you in less than 45 minutes, what I'm doing here is to offer you a few points of entry where these overlapping connecting histories can kind of become visible to a certain extent for you. And the first one is about the institution, the museum, and abstract expressionism. And as I said, MoMA was not always a main and chief advocate of the new painting which came into being in the second half of the 1940s in New York. And what I'm showing to you proves that quite wonderfully. This is a flyer which was designed by Odd Reinhardt in 1940. The flyer was used as a kind of, you know, propaganda material, or, you know, it's a flyer. It was distributed in front of the museum itself on April 15, 1940, during a public demonstration which was organized by the American abstract artist It was an organization which was founded in 1934 or something like that, early 1930s here in New York. And they're asking, how modern is the Museum of Modern Art? And in the next slide, I'm showing you this detailed image when you can see that there are two lovely rhetorical questions. Is the artist a reporter? Obviously, no. Is the museum a business? Obviously, no. And here is the most important one. Why and when does a modern museum depart from presenting the art of today to promoting the art of yesterday? Why not day before yesterday? Why not resurrections, adorations, and Madonnas? Well, it's pretty sardonical, and it obviously kind of suggests to us that at a time in the 1940s, MoMA is not yet kind of, you know, ready to support abstract art made by American artists, because both of these things are important. Not only abstract art, but abstract art produced in this country. We know that MoMA had made a commitment which repeatedly reinforced, you know, collecting works, say, by Kazimir Malevich since the 1930s. It was not just the question of abstraction, but American abstraction. So this is where we start. It's a strange love affair, and it did not start as a love affair, like many of the real stories. And after kind of starting with this MoMA and New York School, I will return to this story at the very end of this lecture, so we will see what happened later. But before I would start focusing on the work of the artist on view at this exhibition, I would like us to run through very quickly those kind of historical developments or conditions which made the becoming, the emergence of abstract expressionist painting possible in the second half of the 1940s in New York. So let's see a few things what seems to us today as a necessity or as a momentum or an element which accelerated and contributed to the coming into being of the New York School. And the first thing which I'm showing to you are probably very often kind of, you know, it's a very visible, highly visible photograph featuring a few major European artists who, after the fall of Paris in 1940 June, when Hitler kind of, you know, took over the north of France, came to New York. Some of them came via London, like Mondrian. Here he sits next to Breton. Okay, this is Piet Mondrian. This is André Breton, the head of Surrealism. This is Fernand Léger. This is Max Ernst. And what you see here, basically, it's a whole collection of the most important avant-garde figures who, escaping the war, chose New York as their place of, you know, temporary place of being. This exhibition took place at Pierre Matisse Gallery, very close to us. It used to be on 57th Street, son of Henri Matisse. And it was the first group show featuring the work of European immigrant artists, artists in exile. Well, why is this important? Because up till this point, modernism or progressive, radical avant-garde, whatever you call it, but the European avant-garde production was only present in New York through heavy mediation. Obviously, you know the story, since the Armory and then through Alfred Stieglitz and then many other galleries opening throughout the 20s and the 30s, and also museums like this one, MoMA, and then later the Museum of Non-Objective Painting, today the Guggenheim. There was an institutional network, both public and private and commercial, which made the production of the European avant-garde artist visible. Yet still, mediation means that people make selections, make the work travel. The immediacy of the availability of this production, which was secured by the actual physical presence of these artists in the city, is something, a very important kind of part of our story today. These artists were showing on 57th Street. What they'd done was there, ready to see, ready to talk about, ready to perceive, absorb, and then expand on it. So that's the first step. But also you needed new galleries, galleries which were committed to that kind of production, to the production of, you know, most recent European art and to the production of those artists who were in town temporarily during the war years. And one of the most important protagonists of this story is Peggy Guggenheim, here with a Calder mobile. I love the fact that she's showing a Calder mobile because Calder and Marcel Duchamp are the eminent transatlantic artists, right? They already done what the European exile artists done. Duchamp is coming back and forth between France and the United States since 1915. Calder is based in France in the interwar years and kind of keeps continuing going back and forth throughout his career. So the whole transatlantic itinerary, the exchange between these two arch republics, France and the United States, is very much already evoked by the Calder thing. So here is Peggy Guggenheim, and here is her gallery. I do not have gender in my first language, so whenever I make an obvious mistake, it's a very democratic, anti-sexist kind of, you know, grammatical setup. Not so in the English, so whenever I make a mistake, please keep in mind this. Sorry about that. So, Art of this Century, the gallery whose interior photographs you see here, was, as you see, not only featuring Kandinsky and Maxent's, you know, paintings, and basically the work of everyone who you saw, from Leger to Mondrian, not so much. Mondrian had a gallery, the Valentine Gallery in New York already. So Guggenheim showed her own collection and also the work of those who were here in New York. But it's not only that. Look at the mode of display here. The curved walls, the furniture, which also functioned as a kind of pedestal or sculptural base, these poles, which supported the paintings, which were hanging in free space. It's a little bit like MoMA itself with its first building in 1939, right? The first building designed on 53rd Street. Not only what she showed, but the whole structure of display already and together was a sort of manifesto of radical modernity. Something which was not familiar, something which was not yet seen in New York. So Art of the Century, Guggenheim's gallery, is a tremendously important place, and not just as a gallery, but also as a kind of platform when all the artists who later were associated with the New York School / abstract expressionism were regular visitors. And the last thing, what I wanted to say, that of course Guggenheim also is a model, because many, the most outstanding gallerists in New York in the post-war period are women. Think about Betty Parsons, think about Martha Jackson, even today think about Marianne Goodman. The fact that a woman kind of launches a both commercially, critically, and critically successful kind of enterprise, such as a gallery, which serves as a commercial outlet, but also as an intellectual platform, became a model provided by Peggy Guggenheim for the rest of the century. The next image is Hans Hofmann Spring, kindly and lovingly predated by him on the back. It's dated 1940. Obviously, he wanted to look it a little bit newer and fresher and earlier than Jackson Pollock's own abstract drip paintings, which he started to work on in 1947-48. It's still earlier a little bit, but it's also a tiny little painting which is located on the right wall of the first room on the fourth floor of the fourth floor show, the big picture show. So if you go up, please have a look at it. It's on board oil, and it's a tiny study where he plays with kind of gestural abstraction, the fluidity of pigment, and the layering of paint. The reason why I'm showing it is not because I wanted to introduce Jackson Pollock's drip paintings. The reason why I'm showing it because Hans Hofmann is also a tremendously important figure in this prehistory, or a kind of genealogical overview of abstract expressionism. He has a school since the 1930s, late 20s. He also has the summer school in Providence since the late 1930s. And although not many artists studied with him, but his school creates a kind of social network among many artists later associated directly or via their spouses or friends to the New York School painters. Hans Hofmann's schools and teaching becomes the first kind of loose form of social kind of, you know, group, or a kind of collectivity's experience there, which, as you will see, will be important for us for later development of or the collective representation of the New York School artist. And I think the last, or one before the last slide I'm showing to you, is Arshil Gorky's painting. Gorky, who is a major, major painter, you know, born in Armenia but based in this country. And Gorky's kind of importance is not only visible in the work of the New York School painters, that they were looking intently and closely what Gorky was doing, but Gorky very early was made into basically a kind of prefiguration or a kind of father figure of many of the tenets of abstract expressionist paintings by a very major figure, Clement Greenberg himself. He kind of presented Gorky. He connected Gorky's production to the production of the New York School painters. Question is why? What can we see on this painting, Diary of a Seducer, which makes you think about paintings done by New York School painters? Well, first of all, one kind of very important thing. Look at the marks here. You have areas which are washed out, right? Very thinly painted, washed, thinly painted. You have areas which are almost left empty, blank, reserved, like, you know, in Cézanne, sometimes in Matisse. There are areas which are made or created or marks made in a very linear drawing line, drawing-like kind of, you know, graphic manner. Drawing and painting, pictorial and graphic, linear and large colored kind of areas. You see the painting as a true inventory of different mark-making and surface kind of handling methods and processes, right? It is something which becomes almost like an enumeration of how many ways is out there to make a mark on a two-dimensional surface with oil on a canvas, right? So that's one important thing. The other thing is that you cannot really point to any element of this painting which is more important of the other than the other. This section here or that section is just as important as the central section. Here, he even pushes the form over to the edge, right? He radically decentering the composition, turning it into an all-over kind of structure where the whole kind of, you know, it goes board to board, extends to every section of the surface. That's a second very important thing, what we see, you know, to return with Abegg's paintings. And the third one, which is if you walked into the first room, you saw that, or if you see the graphic section of the shows, you saw that, whether it's Rothko, Newman, or Pollock, they all start with very similar images. Images which look like body parts, the body inside or outside, bodies, but not necessarily human bodies, animal bodies, flowers or eyes, or for the more erotically charged people, maybe a vagina, but something which is in the form of a beginning, something biomorphic, organic, a kind of ambiguous imagery. And that imagery used here by Gorky comes, of course, from surrealism, right? It is the surrealist kind of biomorphic phantasmagoria of creatures, kind of, you know, human and animal crossings, and the capacity of form to morph into something else, this fluidity of forms, and this archaic biomorphic figuration is, of course, something what all the artists of the New York School also used in their early work. And the last slide in this kind of overview of the beginnings or the, maybe the historical conditions of abstract expressionism is a very famous exhibition which took place in 1951, and this was the Ninth Street Show. The Ninth Street Show, which was one of the first model exhibitions for the annuals of painting and sculptures, which started in downtown Manhattan, and these were usually organized by artists themselves. There is, before, you know, the institutional reception of abstract expressionism already, a very committed network of cooperative galleries which existed on the 9th and the 10th Street area in the village, right? And these galleries were run by the artists. They self-organized themselves. They wanted to create an artist-run, artist kind of, you know, managed platform to show work. They wanted to see each other's works as well. That was also behind it, right? So the 9th Street Show was a model show and then was later kind of, you know, continued by Stable Gallery right here in New York, of course. And it's gathered, as you see the names, most of the artists whose work appear on MoMA's exhibition, in MoMA's exhibition, and then some. Okay, now let's see the New York School. I'm showing you a photograph. This is before the Ninth Street Show, but it's a very, very famous photograph, and it's the first and actually the last, I think, I might be mistaken, but I think there's the one and only collective representation of those artists who's, for the lack of a better term, are gathered under the label of abstract expressionism or the New York School. Well, if you've seen the show, you know that it's not everyone is abstract all the time. Not everyone is expressive all the time. So just walking through the fourth floor already demonstrates and makes an excellent point what are the very limitation of this term, abstract expressionism. But you need a name. You need a name because the name is important to create kind of, you know, a platform for institutional reception. So critics can call it, so you know how it's called. And the other name which came into being was, of course, New York School Painting, and New York School Painting was an extension of École de Paris, that is the Parisian school, the interwar years Parisian, very loose group of painters. You see, again, we have the transatlantic scenario. The New York painters want to create a kind of collective group which is fashioned after the Paris network. And of course, Paris is the model for New York, and they're called the Paris only in its name, in its kind of collective utopia, is a model for the abstract expressionists. So that's about the names. Let's talk about this photograph here. Why is the photograph and why are they so angry? They call themselves angry, right? They are irate. So what's going on? Before this picture was taken, the Metropolitan Museum opened an exhibition which was featuring recent American painting. And none of these artists, the artist, of course, in the middle, of course, with a cigarette, Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Barnett Newman, and the dashingly good-looking Willem de Kooning, none of these artists were, of course, featured at this exhibition at the Metropolitan. I'm saying, of course, this is the same complaint what I started with. Remember, Ad Reinhardt. The museums, whether it's a Met or the MoMA, did not seem to be interested in the work of artists who were based here, who worked here in New York. So to create a kind of presence, literally a presence, to say that, look at us, here we are, this is how we look. They published the photograph along with an angry letter in Life magazine. Well, two things are very striking about this picture and the fact that it was published in Life magazine. The first striking thing, of course, that you only have one woman, Hedda Stern, who is represented with one single painting on the fourth floor of the exhibition. That's about the sexual politics of, you know, art before the late 1960s, anywhere in the Western world, except for brief moments in Soviet Russia or in the Berlin Dada, where women were equally represented and present among the rows of artists. So that's one strange thing which I couldn't help myself to mention. And the other is the fact that the photograph itself was published in Life magazine. Let me ask you, since when photographic representation of the most radical painters are published in a middlebrow mass-circulated magazine which has over 3 million subscribers around 1947-48. You've never seen this. This is unprecedented in the history of avant-garde and mass media, right? Think about the European avant-garde. Even, you know, the German expressionists, who were very keen on promoting their work, publishing print portfolios, right? Creating marketing for their work. They never made it, really, into the full acceptation of mass media and middle-class culture in Germany. Of course, there was also Hitler coming in 1933, which kind of crossed their itinerary rather harshly. But this is never before seen. This is only happening right here in the United States. Let's remember this. Let's remember Life magazine, photographic representation, and radical culture. I will return to that in a second. So you see them, and then I'm showing you a catalogue, because I haven't mentioned this so far, but when we do talk about how abstract expressionism and the Museum of Modern Art kind of became a joint story, a closely joint story, it is enormously important for us to remember the name of Dorothy C. Miller. Dorothy Miller, who was the curator of a whole series of exhibitions called The Americans, which started in 1942, and the last took place in 1963. The Americans, right? That is, to create an institutional visibility, to give space, right, for those artists, the Americans, who are not imported from Europe or anywhere else, mostly Europe at this time, so to include their work, to make their work visible for large audiences, not the small audiences of artist-run cooperative galleries, you know, located in the village, but for those who come and visit MoMA. And I'm using 15 Americans from 1942, and I'm showing you two rooms. This is the Pollock room, this is the Rothko room. This might be familiar for you also. This is Gothic. And following the 15 Americans, I'm only focusing here for two artists today, and these two artists will be Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko. And what I'm doing now, I know you're a little bit disappointed, I will be showing a few other slides. It's impossible to do more, and I had to find some kind of thread to how to show you the histories, political, economic, cultural histories, institutional histories, and also to give us a chance to spend some time with the work itself in a form of a close reading, in a form of a, some kind of, you know, with an analytical look at their practices. So I thought that since I want to connect this show, I want to connect their production to the institution, hence 15 Americans and Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko. So let's look into the work now. And I will return to other stories and histories in a second. I'm showing you She-Wolf for one single reason. Many things which I said about the Gorky, layering, different paint application, the spattered, kind of splattered, dripped first layer, you see that here, you see that, widely chromatic. And then the linear drawing-like kind of outlines of this She-Wolf, again, a kind of archaic, totemic being, very much taking back to Picasso's work and the surrealist kind of, you know, figuration. And then this third layer, the gray area which he painted around, almost kind of showing us the figure and then the first layer underneath, as those would emerge from this painted kind of frame. There is an idea of layering, creating geological strata, right? This is his pictorial interest, but you've seen better paintings than this. Although it's important because, as you see, this was both up by Peggy Guggenheim, of course, also gave Pollock his first solo exhibition in 43, and MoMA, and that's the beginning of the warming up between the painters and the museum, both this painting from the first show, the first museum purchase of Pollock by any museum in the United States. And, you know, this is also a kind of genealogical arch painting. This is how the fourth floor starts. You remember the first kind of slide I show you. So this is where we start, and this is where we go. And I need to make this somewhat quick, so I'm making this somewhat quick. What you're looking into is 1948, one of the first number one, now most recently called number 1A, 1948, which is an oil and enamel paint by Rothko. What changed? Well, many things changed. First of all, the most important thing, what you see here was painted on an easel attached to a wall. It was painted vertically. It was layered. What Pollock is doing here, he keeps the idea of layering, of building, constructing a painting from lines, which is not even a pictorial thing to do. It's more like drawing when you build, construct, juxtapose lines. So essentially a kind of graphic drawing-based approach is extended, again, all over to the whole surface, the combination of materials, oil and enamel, on an unprimed canvas. That's very good. The figure, of course, disappears. What else is happening? Well, this was, of course, not painted vertically, but horizontally. And everything, the reason why Pollock is so important, but the reason what gives Pollock's kind of, you know, iconic status within any kind of story, whether master narrative or not master narrative, of late modernist painting, all it has to do with horizontality. What happens when Pollock puts the canvas down to the floor to produce a painting? Well, many, many things. I'm only concentrating or focusing here on three really quickly. First of all, what you do then if you paint a horizontal surface, especially if the surface is large enough. And in order for him to secure the fluidity of the lines, he needed the large surface, right? So what is happening, he basically, you know, soaking the brush or the paint stick or whatever was at hand, or sometimes just pouring the paint straight out of the can, he makes gesture over the horizontally placed canvas. Big swinging gestures, seen by Robert Goodnow in 1951, a journalist who wrote about Pollock in Art News, as a ritual dance, right? Swinging his whole body, not painting from the arm and the elbow, painting with the whole moving body, dynamizing the body. So what you see, all these traces here, very literally, are in a way indexical traces, right? The prints of a dynamic motion, body, and paintings, the painting, the process of painting becomes a physical corporeal performance and event. That's the first consequence of horizontality, the horizontal placement. The second is something quite obvious. When you have a vertical surface, you can compose. We do compose using our vertebrae as a spatial axis. When we say left, when we say right, when we say up, when we say down, we project our own body to that vertical surface which confronts us, which faces us. If you put an object, a canvas, and I would like to imagine that this is now on the floor, you can't project your own body to that canvas for a very simple reason. Since you can circulate and walk around the canvas, right? Saying where is the left, right, up, down does not make any sense, because as soon as you change your position in relation to the canvas, what used to be now up becomes left or right, or one more turn around and it becomes down. So you see, the spatial hierarchy, the projective spatial hierarchy, starting with the body of the canvas, disappears when it is on the floor, so you cannot compose. All that remains from this hierarchy on the surface is center and periphery, middle and the rest. There's a second consequence. And the third one has to do with chance. Pollock famously stated in a statement, when I am in a painting, right? I'm not aware of what am I doing. Why? First of all, and most importantly, what happens, not first of all, I'm only bringing in one aspect of this. When something is on the floor in front of you, even that scale, this is a relatively small painting, you can see the dimensions are always indicated, the dimensions, because these are very important, but you of course also know one from 1950, which is a monumental kind of, you know, mural-sized painting in the same room next to this painting on the fourth floor. When something is on the floor, whether it's average-scaled or giant, you always see it in a perspectival distortion, right? In order to see what you've done after splattering, kind of dripping the paint on the surface, you need to turn it back. You need to kind of tilt it against the wall. You need to turn it back to this kind of position, what we associate with art and culture, which is the vertical thing against the wall. If you don't do that, and Pollock sometimes did it, sometimes didn't do it, sometimes it was one-shot technique, sometimes it was not one-shot. But whenever you paint, the immediate possibility of controlling, seeing, seizing, and scanning what you've just done is not given for you because of the horizontal placement of the canvas. So what he does is not just some metaphysical thing about painting blindly. It's a very real kind of phenomenologically determined condition in painting that he does not see what he's doing. Right? He can't control it. So these are the three things which we can associate briefly with the modality of horizontal painting, that the painting is produced on the floor, which of course changes everything what we know about surface, mark, structure, composition, and the role of the body in painting, in abstract painting. And then there are all the photographs, which actually were even more frequently disseminated. Pollock was received as a media figure. These photographs taken by Hans Namuth, the German photographer who was his neighbor in Long Island, the very famous photograph here, he is doing it, and here is Lee Krasner, the painter, also his wife at the time, in the barn which Pollock used as a studio in the Springs on Long Island. These photographs showing him in action, kind of showing you, kind of disclosing the very process of making, were enormously kind of influential, almost more influential than the paintings, I might have to say. And you might be asking again, since when do we see painters in action in the studio, not posing, right, for in a representational kind of conventional way, but in a snapshot when you see them while they are painting? This is also a very unusual kind of occurrence. And we are coming back to life, and we are coming back to the idea that how come that in 1949, in August, I think August 8, Life magazine appeared on the newsstands in the United States featuring Jackson Pollock on the cover. It's an image similar to that, cigarette, jeans, black jacket, very masculine, very virile, very creative, very cutting edge, very not like Sargent, right? Or, you know, anyone else who's kind of, you know, was popular as a painter in this country before him. And of course, Sargent is a stretch, but you get an idea. This is a very unconventional self-representation or representation for an artist to choose or to accept. So he was on the cover of Life, and Life asked, is he the greatest living painter in the United States? The question was repeated at the beginning of this double spread, which I'm showing to you right here. And again, I would like you to ponder for a second. How come that Life magazine is interested in contemporary vanguard painting? A painting which is not easy to understand. The kind of painting which challenged critics and audiences alike. Right? Understanding what was at stake for Pollock in this shift to horizontality. What was at stake in this kind of corporally induced, large-scale, abstract painting, what we call drip. Right, which he produced for a very short amount of time. You know, he changed the work and then he died very early in 1956. But it is a very unusual kind of frame in which issues related to vanguard culture appear, not Life magazine. Well, Life magazine in this country. So it is important for us to see this. Why was so important to embrace Pollock? Why was so important to publish the photograph of those painters? And there is a question here, of course. And very slowly and very surely, well, the story started to emerge, of course, that after initial difficulties, what became evident that if the United States want to reinforce its military, economic, and political positioning during the Cold War years, being one of the superpowers, right? And if it wants to exercise and demonstrate and further its influence in Western Europe, which was fed by the Marshall Plan almost literally since 1947, the federal aid which was given to the European, Western European countries, the United States will need to come up with a kind of cultural, an image, a kind of, you know, an image which kind of declares the country or has the capacity to show the country not just as a military and financial superpower, but also a country which can demonstrate and create and instigate a kind of culture which is equal, at least, with Western European, you know, European avant-garde. It was a need, kind of, you know, to frame, to come up with an artist collective. And of course, and it wasn't as simple as I'm telling you now, but, you know, we do not have a 3-week-long workshop about this. So I will return to this story. That is, again, I'm throwing it up, and I will return to it in a minute later. But to show how Pollock's figure indeed, through the mass media, through a kind of institutional reception, let's remember the painting which was bought by this museum, right, in 1943, Pollock's kind of, you know, the dissemination of his image, and when I say his image, I'm not only referring to his painting, more of his image, as a new type of artist, as the American artist, right? So here is a film from 1951 showing him, made by Namuth and Paul Falkenberg. It was never really finished, but you see four stills where he paints on a sheet of glass. I'm just showing you for the sake of lovely formal analogy. This is David Smith's Australia, which is obviously located in the Pollock Room on the fourth floor, problematizing the notion of painting and sculpture and painting and drawing retrospectively, of course. The idea that a sculpture can be made by this thin graphic kind of, you know, linear presence of matter in space. And Pollock's painting, as I try to explain, also comes out of this linear kind of drawing-like application. But the interesting thing is right here. If I would have shown these two images for you, you probably would have believed that, of course, Pollock's film still comes after Picasso's. Well, not. Clouzot's, Henri-Georges Clouzot's film, Le Mystère de Picasso, The Mystery of Picasso, shot in 1956. It's a documentary about Picasso. This scene, when, you know, a different form of virility, smaller scaled, bulkier, but virile nonetheless, you know, half naked, drawing on a sheet of glass. This, I'm not suggesting that there is a direct connection, but I want to use this as an emblem. This is what happens. Pollock's figure, and then the New York School basically makes what a few scholars called, and I'm going a little bit ahead here, the stealing of the idea of modern art by New York. Pollock, Abstract Expressionism, and the New York School are creating this transatlantic shift of modernism, as it is often called in the literature, where, and I'm going back, sorry about the jumping here, where suddenly America produced a new collective. Whether how collective and closely knit this was, that's another question. But there are American artists who are not emulating and following the model of European art the first time in the history of modern Western art, but this order, which is of course about the dynamics of power and many other things, has changed. What Pollock is doing, what Franz Kline is doing, what Mark Rothko or Barnett Newman is doing right here in New York becomes a model for Europeans. This change, right? It's an enormously important change. And as soon as MoMA realized that these artists can kind of contribute, you know, or can create, or are the group which can generate or contribute to this change, this is when MoMA's and Abstract Expressionism relation obviously started to change. I will return to that. It's not just about arts and politics, institutions, and Cold War strategies to create an image, a new image for the United States, which also kind of, you know, invests into cultural representation, but also, of course, art and commodity, that long old story. And when I'm talking about Life magazine and Pollock, Life magazine and the New York School painters, of course, we have to say this mass mediatized reception and presence was quite exceptional because it guaranteed the access to radical art for many, many people. You can consider this as an essentially democratic operation, right? It's a non-elitist democratic operation, but something else is happening, of course. As soon as the mass media receives the artist and the art, it's not just about reception, but also, of course, co-optation, commodification. And this is how Jackson Pollock can be turned into a fashion shot backdrop by the lovely photograph made by Cecil Beaton for Vogue's The New Soft Look, that was the title of the editorial. Well, it's a pretty complex story. And the other one is maybe less politically kind of, you know, motivated, or most not obviously so, but it's also a very complicated one, and that's the story of Mark Rothko. And I'm using the word story because especially in the Rothko room, which is a quite exceptional room on the fourth floor, you can, of course, see the whole room becomes almost like a miniature retrospective exhibition. It starts with this painting in 1948, where I would like to yet again refer back to Gorky. Remember Gorky's kind of play with different paint application and all over, how thin or thick, how the black can be, you know, 15 black, not one, but many colors, due to the differently layered and applied kind of paint to the surface. Well, in Rothko's work, you can, of course, see that. The other thing what you see is that he uses color as a field, and that is the Matissean legacy. He just takes away the figure, just as Pollock kind of eliminated the figure. Matisse, who uses color as a laterally extended field in his works from around 1908, 1909, and color which dictates and governs and structures the whole surface of the painting in Matisse's hand is something which has no direct meaning. It's a very dangerous thing to give color such a role. Think about the red studio on the fifth floor. What is red there? The wall, the floor, the furniture, everything is red. So what is red? Nothing. What does red stand for? For nothing. It does not have meaning, it does not have significance, yet it is the single most important element in the painting which is responsible for the whole organization of space, movement, dynamic, and perception. So Matt Rothko starts with this. He picks up the idea of color as a field from Matisse and then takes it to a very different place. I'm showing you this from 1950, not because I'm showing you the paintings in a chronological order, because just as I wanted you to see the Pollock, the first Pollock bought by the museum, I want you to see this Rothko, the first Rothko, which became part of the permanent collection of the museum 9 years after the entry of the Pollock. 1952, after the 15 Americans. Remember I showed you in black and white this painting? This painting was on you in Dorothy Miller's exhibition. MoMA decided to buy it. One of the trustees of the museum, as probably you heard this story, it's a very often kind of oft-told story, one of the trustees of the museums resigned because he could not accept the idea that the museum is actually investing into something so vapid, vacant, and non-comprehensible than this painting. See, it's still in the works, the relationship between this museum and the New York School painters. And I'm showing you this shot because I want us to keep this sweeping, almost panoramic look, which is, of course, also very, very misleading because Rothko, it always seems striking, overwhelming, enormously decorative, yet it's everything but quick painting. Sweeping gazes are never, never appropriate. What you need to do is to spend a lot of time each of these paintings, because what he also spent a lot of time on them. That's no reason. That's not a good enough, kind of reason to do so, though. Let's see what's happening in these slides. First, he's using the color fields in a violently contrasted manner. You see that? And then he starts to kind of tone them down. Less color, less tone, less volume. In these two paintings, he actually names, the titles are always numerical titles, but the subtitle very often names the color. Here he says slate blue and brown on plum. Here he says red, brown, and black, because those were the colors which he applied first. You, of course, know that if you ever seen this painting in up close, that this is only steel blue in the first second. You spend 5 more seconds with it, and then it's not going to be steel blue anymore. It will become something gray, blue, green, black, brown, red. Because what Rothko, of course, is doing with these floating colored rectangles is color rectangles, is to make you realize that color is, of course, depends on the interactions in the presence, on the presence of other colors. Colors depends on luminosity, the luminosity of the neighboring colors, its own luminosity. Color depends on the surface area, the lesson of Matisse. Color also depends on the paint application. And color is never one fixed, static, materially kind of, recorded thing on a piece of canvas. Color is fluid. Color does change. You cannot locate color. This is the game. It takes a long time. It takes a kind of meditative, contemplative approach for you to scan through the whole surface and think about, what am I looking at? What do I see? How would I describe the color sensation, right, which emerges on my retina and then my brain and my language tries to catch up with it? Well, your language cannot catch up with it. And Rothko knew that. So in this very last painting from 1961, he renounced of naming the color. All he says is this, see this? Horizontals, and indeed they are horizontals. They suggest a very, very different perceptual experience, right? It's not about the overwhelming kind of labyrinthic maze of a soaked, dyed, large Rothko surface. It's a very different scale painting. But the most important that he says white over darks. Of course he says that. No one knows the difference between these two blues. Which is bluer? And what's the difference between this brown and that brown? And then I haven't even said that this section of the brown and that section of the brown is not the same again. Can language describe color? No. What is brown for you might be maroon for me. Are we looking at the same thing? Yes, we do. The kind of taxonomy, the arbitrary rigor of how language nominates things. How do we use words to describe something as corporeal, as perceptual, as fleeting and fluid as color? Language is a not sufficient mean to do that. And Rothko kind of acknowledges that. So it starts as an exercise in perception, in phenomenology, in space, in color, as a meditative process, right? And then with this last painting, we realize that what he wants you to see also to think about color and language, color and knowledge. That is, he turns his painting into a kind of epistemological exercise. Can I name it? Do I know it if I cannot name it? It's a very lovely question to finish this. And I'm showing his photograph. This is his photograph in the studio. And to finish really quickly, I would like to show, to come back to this story of politics, museums, critics, painting, and exhibitions. I'm showing you the new American painting at the Museum of Modern Art, which was curated by the Museum of Modern Art, again by Dorothy C. Miller, and which traveled to 8 European countries during 58 and 59. And everything which I said about the need for the United States, and also the need for these artists to kind of to receive a large, broad visibility, right? And how this need was fed into or conjointly also created along with the United States kind of Cold War representation. This is the story about this exhibition basically finalized and shown. The New American Painting was a very controversial, sometimes hated, sometimes admired kind of enterprise, which tried to show to Western Europe that America indeed now have great painters, as Henri Matisse said in 1930. Very few people actually believed him in 1930, but in 1958, 59, this exhibition hoped or aimed to show that indeed this is now the case. And here is again the book, which in 1984 kind of connected these polyphonic histories from the angle of politics and Cold War strategy and cultural diplomacy, and presented us with the story. And three paintings I would like to show you. One, this is Seeing Anew. After the triumph of Abstract Expressionism, MoMA organizing the exhibitions, the international exhibitions, to show them. MoMA is also doing something else, and this is what great painting or a collectively emerging kind of, you know, group can do to us. The big pictures, the large scale, the fluidity, the obstruction, all those features what we could see in the work of New York School painters made us retrospectively think about the history of painting as well. When you go back and start to think about the production of Claude Monet in different terms, because seeing large-scale monumental painting in New York in the 40s and 50s make us to see Monet again from a different place, to think about scale in Monet, painterly application in Monet differently. So what I'm showing to you is the first installation of Claude Monet's Water Lilies, built in 1959 by Alfred H. Barr Jr., who was also at the time curator and the founding director of this museum, to bring it into almost create a genealogy for Pollock, for Barnett Newman, and for those really large-scale canvases to show that, see, this is how there is a kind of dialectical relationship between those two. And the next one is a woman. And I'm showing you a woman, Joan Mitchell, because I wanted to show you a woman, because Joan Mitchell, the MoMA has many great Joan Mitchell paintings, but they were not recently kind of figured as part of the Abstract Expressionist or New York School kind of narrative. They were shown in the atrium on their own, separately from their immediate artistic and social and political context. You can see Joan Mitchell here, and you can see a painting, and this show gives you a chance to kind of reinsert the missing people, right? To not just to deal the master narrative, but to think about artists who were not constitutively made part of your knowledge or our kind of, you know, conceptions regarding the New York School painters. And Joan Mitchell's Ladybug, which is one of the greatest work on the fourth floor, gives you a chance to think about the body, gives you a chance to think about action, painting as an enormously violent act. Look at those lines, the beginning of a gesture which she interrupts violently. It's all about broken units of gestural lines. Broken. She breaks them. It's a kind of paroxysmal, disciplined way of starting with an enormously invested, aggressive stroke and then stop it halfway. You never seen violence, not maybe in the Kooning, only in the Kooning. Violence, the physical, corporal investment of a body so obviously translated into the surface, into the matter of painting than here. And then think about it for a second. Why is this so enormously compelling and beautiful? How come that violence and decoration, and I will use the word beauty, the chromatic illuminated scintillation throughout this painting, with its very Matissean kind of colors, right? How those two things can coexist? Can they coexist in abstract painting, violence and beauty? Kind of chromatic richness and paroxysmal aggression, the level of gesture. It's, this show gives us a chance to think about that, right? And the last thing I'm showing to you is this. Oops, sorry. Yeah. I'm skipping this. And I want to finish with this painting for two reasons. Ed Reinhardt, remember? Angry, April 15, 1940. Well, today he hangs on the fourth floor, one of the last rooms of the big picture. I want to finish with Ed Reinhardt for two reasons. It's a very polemical end, I warn you in advance. First of all, this painting was not well received in New York. It wasn't even on view in New York the first time. It was on view in Paris, back to Paris, in the Galerie Iris Claire in 1963. Right? But also you can consider this as American painters, the models, those who are being emulated, are now going back showing, just as Europeans were coming here. Think about the dynamic of cultural geography and exchange here. And think about something. How is it possible that, you know, Reinhardt believed that this is the end game of painting? What started with abstract expressionism kind of ends here with him, the black paintings, the very last paintings when someone can paint. Think about it. How is it possible that all the varieties of painting from Joan Mitchell, right, to Rothko, to Pollock, to Gorky, and then I end with a painting which is not about vision, right? It's not about color, it's not about gesture, it's about blindness. It seems like the very opposite, the diametrically opposed other, what we consider painting. And I would like to leave you with a text which will not necessarily help you to understand it, but it will help you to keep thinking about it. And the text is from, of course, Reinhardt, and from a text which was published originally in French in 1963 in Paris. A square canvas, 5 feet wide, 5 feet high, as high as a man, as wide as a man's outstretched arms, trisected, one horizontal form negating one vertical form, free, dark, no contrasting colors. Brushwork, brush that to remove brushwork, a matte, flat, freehand, painted surface, I'm skipping, it's very long, which does not reflect its surroundings, a pure, abstract, non-objective, timeless, spaceless, changeless, relationless, disinterested painting, an object that is self-conscious, ideal, transcendent, aware of nothing but art. Thank you very much.